Tanta Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Plato of Athens, A Life in Philosophy, by Robin Waterfield. Narrated by Tristram Summers. Preface. The prospect of writing a biography of Plato is daunting, and many have judged it a lost cause. The sources are mostly thin and unreliable, the information sporadic and often uncertain, the chronology of his written works impossible to determine with precision. No official Athenian documents survive that mention him. Moreover, Plato hardly refers to himself in the dialogues, as his written works are called, and never speaks in his own name. Nevertheless, as I hope this book demonstrates, a book-length treatment is both possible and desirable. As well as unearthing biographical details, one has to delve into many areas that have the potential, fundamentally, to impact what one thinks of Plato, such as, what kind of writer was he? How should we read the dialogues he wrote? Is what we call Platonism true to its origins? Plato is a household name, a rare status for a philosopher, and he effectively invented the discipline we call philosophy. It would be good to gain some idea of the man himself. Naturally, many books on Plato start with a chapter or a few paragraphs on his life, but, as far as I am aware, the last dedicated biography in English of any length was published in 1839, when B.B. Edwards translated Life of Plato by Wilhelm Tennemann and included it in his and E.A. Park's Selections from German Literature. The book you hold in your hands shares with this predecessor little except a critical approach. That is, I do not just write down facts and conclusions, but also, to a certain extent, suitable for a book designed for a general audience, explain what the evidence is and how I understand it, because nothing is uncontroversial in Plato studies. But otherwise, my book is different in that it ranges wider and is longer than Edwards' 56 pages. And since the main fact about Plato's life is that he was a writer, my book will also serve as an introduction to his work. I do mean introduction. Finer points of interpretation and philosophical complexities play no part, and I have towed a fairly conservative line on most issues that exercise interpreters of Plato. This is not a book about Plato's philosophy, but about Plato, though, as a biography of a philosopher, references to aspects of his thought are inevitable. But I focus more on general characteristics than the particulars and the ever-contended details. I am more likely to tantalise listeners with suggestive and intriguing ideas of Plato's than elaborate them or spell out their pros and cons. After about 2,400 years, Plato's books have scarcely aged. They are as brilliant, witty, profound, and perplexing as they have always been. Most of them are not only inspired, but inspiring. They are very enjoyable to read, and even the few drier ones contain ingenious and delightful passages. No philosopher is as accessible to non-specialists as Plato. I hope that this book will stimulate listeners to turn next to reading the dialogues themselves and to find out more about Plato's work. To this end, I have appended a fairly long bibliography. In terms of my personal biography, the book is a kind of summation, the fruit of many years of thinking and writing about Plato, not that he has always been my exclusive focus. Almost the first article I had published more than 40 years ago was on the chronology of Plato's dialogues, a topic that, naturally, has exercised me in this biography. So, although I now disagree with the thesis of that article, the book completes a circle for me. List of Plato's dialogues. All Plato's works are conventionally called dialogues, even though some scarcely involve any give and take between interlocutors, and one, Apology of Socrates, is an alleged transcript of the defence speeches Socrates, Plato's teacher, gave at his trial in 399 BCE. Throughout the book, I use the standard means of precise reference to Platonic texts. I might refer, for instance, to Lysis 222 A-C. These numbers and letters refer to the pages and sections of pages of the edition of Plato's works by Henri Estienne, a.k.a. Stephanus, that was published in Geneva in 1578. This edition was in three volumes, each with separate pagination. Each page was divided into two columns, with the Greek text on the right and a Latin translation on the left. The column with the Greek text was divided into, usually, five sections labelled A to E by Stephanus. So, Lysis 222 A to C is a chunk of text that occupied some or all of sections A to C of page 222 in one of Stephanus's volumes, the second, as it happens. This convention is followed in all editions of Plato's works and by those who write about him. We have the complete works of Plato. There is, these days, a high degree of unanimity among scholars as to which dialogues are genuine and which are not. I count 28 as genuine. This is a good number of titles, but Plato was not an especially prolific writer. These 28 dialogues amount to somewhat over 540,000 words, which is about the same as David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest. By contrast, we have about 1 million words from Aristotle's pen. And if we had his lost works, the figure would probably be nearer 3 million. But prolificness is not the only criterion by which to judge a writer. Plato was creative and original in everything he wrote. Here is an alphabetical list of the genuine dialogues, many of them named after one of the lead characters who appears in the work. Most of them feature Socrates as the main driver of the discussion. First, Alcibiades. Apology of Socrates, often shortened to Apology. Charmides. Cratylus. Critias. Crito. Euthydemus. Euthyphro. Gorgias. Hippias Major. Hippias Minor. Ion. Lacus. Laws. Lysis. Menexenus. Meno. Parmenides. Phaedo. Phaedrus. Philebus. Protagoras. Republic. The first chapter of Republic probably started life as a separate short dialogue called Thrasymachus. Sophist. Statesman, or Politicus. Symposium. Theaetetus. Timaeus. The Platonic corpus contains other works as well. Ignoring those that were recognised as spurious even in antiquity, we have Second Alcibiades, Clitophon, Epinomis, Hipparchus, Lovers, or Rival Lovers, Minos, and Theages. Of these, Second Alcibiades, Hipparchus, Lovers, and Minos are, I would say, certainly not by Plato. Clitophon and Theages probably are not Platonic, but they are of considerable interest as 4th or early 3rd century dialogues, possibly even composed by members of Plato's academy, and the same may be true for Hipparchus, Lovers, and Minos. Epinomis, a kind of appendix to Laws, was written by Plato's student and secretary, the mathematician Philip of Opus, as a commentary on and development of certain parts of Laws and Timaeus. At some point in the past 200 years, almost every single dialogue that I count as genuine has been regarded as spurious by some scholars. But the two that still most commonly fall under suspicion are First Alcibiades and Hippias Major. On the authenticity of some of Plato's letters, see pages XXX to XXXV. Introduction. Plato's importance as a philosopher is universally acknowledged. He was the first Western thinker systematically to address issues that still exercise philosophers today in fields such as metaphysics, epistemology, political theory, jurisprudence and penology, ethics, science, religion, language, art and aesthetics, friendship, and love. He was the heir to a long tradition of thinking about the world and its inhabitants, but the use he made of this inheritance was original. In effect, he invented philosophy, and he did so at a time when there was little vocabulary or framework for doing so. No words for universal, attribute, abstract, and so on. Moreover, he founded a school, the Academy, which was dedicated not just to philosophy, but to scientific research and practical politics, and fostered thinkers of the stature of Aristotle and Eudoxus, whose multiple influences on subsequent thinkers were profound. The Academy taught philosophy and encouraged research for almost 1,000 years, a span still unsurpassed by any other educational establishment in the West. The range of topics Plato addressed, the depth with which he addressed them, and the boldness of his theories are astonishing. It is not just that he raised questions that still provoke us, but he also asked, as a philosopher must, whether it is possible to come up with secure answers to the questions, and even whether knowledge is possible at all. He was concerned not just with conclusions, but with how we reach them. He had certain definite doctrines, or theories perhaps, but even they might find themselves tested in the dialogues. This sense of philosophy as an ongoing quest is one of the most attractive features of his work. What is more, these ideas are generally presented in a way that is accessible to every intelligent reader because Plato's brilliance as a philosopher was matched by his talent as a writer. In later centuries, many thinkers have written philosophical dialogues, but none of those dialogues has captured the fluency and conversational realism of Plato's work at its best. I said just now that Plato raised questions that still provoke us, but the us in that sentence consists chiefly of practicing philosophers. It is more to the point to say that he raised questions that should still provoke us. All of us, not just philosophers. In a world in which even liberal democracies can be distorted by fanatical, incompetent, and emotionally immature leaders, should we perhaps not pay more attention to Plato's prescriptions for turning out political leaders who are both competent and principled? In a world in which information and misinformation are more widespread than ever before, especially thanks to social media and the internet, should we not reconsider Plato's insistence that our actions should be based on knowledge, not belief or opinion? When many perpetuators of popular culture drag us down to the level of the lowest common denominator, let's reflect on Plato's reasons for loathing both trivialization and the unthinking acceptance of ideas and practices, even when they are widely sanctioned by society. Plato was an idealist in that he believed that perfection, or at least a far better state of affairs, is achievable in every area of human life, starting with personal reformation. Should we not similarly devote our energies to improving ourselves and the world around us, so that each generation bequeaths to the next conditions that are healthier and more sustainable than what went before? Plato's work generated discussion and responses throughout antiquity, and in every generation since. There is still such an enormous output of scholarly books and articles every year that it would take more than a single lifetime to master all the publications and all the languages required to read them. He is read and studied in, I dare say, every country in the world. The indexes of a good proportion of the non-fiction books on any reader's shelf will have an entry for Plato. Plato was not just important, but super important, and so he has been judged by some of the greatest intellects of recent times. Perhaps the most famous such assessment is that of the English philosopher Alfred North Whitehead, 1861-1947, who wrote in Process and Reality, published in 1929, the safest general characterization of the European philosophical tradition is that it consists of a series of footnotes to Plato. I believe this to be correct, in the sense that Plato invented what we call the discipline of philosophy, though like all great thinkers and innovators, he also built on the work of his predecessors. He could have echoed Isaac Newton. If I have seen further, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants. But let's be clear on what Whitehead was saying. Every great Western thinker, from Aristotle onward, has been indebted to Plato. Aristotle's debts are more close and obvious than those of, say, Judith Butler, but the foundations of even Butler's work were laid down by Plato. If the mark of genius, rather than merely great intelligence, is that the field in which the person works is forever changed, or a new field created, then Plato was a genius. In saying that he invented philosophy, Whitehead and I are not saying that he got everything right. Of course not. That would make all subsequent philosophy even more of a waste of time than many people already think it is. And in any case, it is the job of philosophy to inquire, more than it is to come up with solutions. Plato launched philosophical investigation. Whitehead's estimation of Plato is so famous that it has long had the status of a cliché. But it is not commonly noted that Whitehead was preceded on the other side of the Atlantic by Ralph Waldo Emerson, leader of the Transcendentalists. Whitehead was ensconced within the establishment, while Emerson was more of an outsider. Perhaps this is why the latter's saying has been forgotten. Out of Plato, Emerson said in his chapter on Plato in Representative Men, 1876, come all things that are still written and debated among men of thought. We note his all things, a measure of Plato's great importance. I could add testimonials from many others, such as Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, 1770-1831, who said in his Lectures on the History of Philosophy that Plato and Aristotle, above all others, deserve to be called the teachers of the human race. I could add testimonials from thinkers and commentators of our own time, but it is the way of things that current philosophers and scholars have not yet passed the test of time and attained the stature of Whitehead, Emerson, and others. So I rest my case on these quotations from earlier thinkers, and on the fact that Republic, at least, and often more of Plato's works, are invariably included in the canon of great books of the world. Nor is this reverence for his books a new phenomenon. Most ancient Greek literature has been lost, sometimes by accident, but more often because it was felt to be not worth preserving, in the sense that, in the centuries before the invention of the printing press, no one was asking scribes to make copies. Yet we have the complete set of Plato's dialogues. Not a single word that he published has been lost. Every generation of readers in antiquity and the Middle Ages felt that Plato's work was worth preserving. In short, without Plato, European culture would be poorer, or at least it would have had to struggle to attain the same richness. Plato cannot be dismissed as just a dead white male. It is safe to say that, apart from the Bible, no body of written work has had such an impact on the Western world as Plato's dialogues. Over the centuries, Platonism has reappeared in some form or other, in philosophical contexts, in much of early Jewish, Christian, and Islamic thought, in the ideas of the Cambridge Platonists, such as Henry Moore and Ralph Cudworth, in the slightly later 17th century dispute between John Locke and Gottfried Leibniz, even in the late 19th century Platonism of Gottlob Frege's mathematical philosophy. But that is not my point, which is that Plato bears some responsibility for forming and tuning the way all of us think, whatever our gender, skin colour, cultural background, or philosophical or political affiliation. In saying this, I am not promoting the chauvinistic notion that the only discipline worthy of the name philosophy is the Western version, founded by Plato. But I am saying that, whether or not we know it, our minds have been affected by him. Moreover, I have suggested that he still has important lessons for us, that he should continue to affect the way we think about many of the issues that currently trouble or perplex us. This book, then, attempts to contextualize the work of this important thinker and to uncover, as much as possible, what else he did other than write books. The sources. How do we know about Plato's life? What are the sources, and how reliable are they? In Plato's case, they are peculiarly intriguing. There are three kinds of source: biographies written in antiquity, letters written in antiquity under Plato's name, and Plato's own published works. All three of these sources are problematic in their own distinct ways. There are also countless references to Plato by other ancient writers, but they are concerned with philosophy rather than biography. Ancient biographies of Plato. 6 ancient lives of Plato exist in whole or part. Philodemus of Gadara, in the 1st century BCE, included a critical account of Plato's life in the part of his massive History of the Philosophers that was dedicated to the history of the Academy. What remains of this text, however, is fragmentary. It exists only on carbonized papyrus rolls from Herculaneum in Italy, burned and preserved by the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in 79 CE, and the delicate and highly technical work of reading the papyri is still ongoing. Moreover, what remains deals largely with the Academy. Most of the details of Plato's life are missing, and little is added in this respect to what we can gather from the other lives, which have survived complete. These surviving lives are, in chronological order, On Plato and His Teaching, 2nd century CE, by the novelist and Platonist Apuleius of Medaurus; the third chapter of the Lives of the Eminent Philosophers, 3rd century CE, by the biographer Diogenes Laertius; the opening sections of Commentary on Plato's First Alcibiades, 6th century CE, by the Platonist scholar Olympiodorus the Younger; an anonymous Prolegomena to Platonic Philosophy, 6th century CE, and the entry Plato in the Dictionary of Wise Men, distinguished in the field of intellectual studies, 6th century CE, by Hesychius of Miletus. Three features of these biographies catch our attention straight away. First, they were all written centuries after Plato's life. Second, with the exception of the one written by Diogenes Laertius, they are all very short. Apuleius devotes about 800 words to Plato's life before turning to his teachings, while Hesychius gives our philosopher about 600 words, including a summary of his ideas. Olympiodorus and the anonymous Prolegomena come in at somewhat over 2,000 words, and Diogenes at about 4,000, before turning to his philosophical theories. Third, they all rely heavily on anecdotes, and they retell many of the same anecdotes, which shows that they were writing at the end of what was already a long tradition, during which these facts about Plato's life became dogma, often an entertaining kind. So I'm little concerned to identify the particular sources on which these extant lives drew. They all drew, ultimately, on the tradition. The tradition's roots go back to the 4th century BCE, because biographies, memoirs, and commemorative poems were written by some of Plato's followers, and others in the decades immediately after his death in 347. Aristotle and Speusippus wrote poems. Speusippus, Xenocrates, and Philip of Opus wrote biographies, probably of an encomiastic nature. Erastus of Sepsis and a certain Asclepiades wrote memoirs. In the next generation, Dicaeacus of Messana, Satyrus of Colatis, and Neanthes of Cyzicus wrote biographies, and Clearchus of Soli wrote an encomium, perhaps trying to counteract the effect of hostile accounts of Plato, because they too started early. Theopompus of Chios wrote a book, Against the School of Plato, in which he seems to have charged Plato with writing many falsehoods and focusing on stuff that was useless. Idomeneus of Lampsacus wrote a book, On the Followers of Socrates, that recounted gossipy scandals. Aristoxenus of Tarsus's Life of Plato, as far as we can tell from the few surviving fragments, drew on gossipy anecdotes and accused Plato of plagiarism and much else besides. Phineus of Eresus must have included something about Plato in his On the Socratics. The Sicilian historian Philistus wrote a hostile account of Plato's visits to Sicily, and comic playwrights were ridiculing Plato even during his lifetime, though not all their remarks were hostile. He is mocked above all for his obscurity, his dependence on wealthy patrons, and the uselessness of philosophy, but these were standard slurs about intellectuals. None of these works from the 4th or early 3rd centuries survive, except for a few snippets, but there can be no doubt that they are the ultimate sources for what we find in the extant biographies. After all, many of them were written by people whom later writers could take to be authoritative, especially Speusippus and Xenocrates. Speusippus was Plato's nephew, and succeeded him as head of the school, and Xenocrates succeeded Speusippus. Other lives were written over the centuries. The tradition was being perpetuated. But, like their 4th and 3rd century predecessors, these works are lost, and it is the later, extant lives that form the foundation of what we know, or think we know, about Plato's life. Leaving aside their accounts of Plato's philosophy, they all cover much the same topics: Plato's birth, name, ancestry, and early education. My Chapter 1. His association with Socrates and other thinkers. Chapter 2. His travels, especially to Sicily. Chapters 3, 4, and 7. The foundation of the Academy. Chapter 5. And his death. Chapter 8. I shall be drawing on the extant lives in their proper contexts, but unfortunately, little of this ancient biographical tradition is reliable. The general picture of the trajectory of Plato's life is more or less sound, but when it comes to details, the tradition often turns gossipy or downright fanciful. These writers were the ancient equivalent of celebrity gossip journalists. Common sense is the best tool with which to assess anecdotes, and it is not difficult to dismiss out of hand the notion that members of the Academy, Plato's school, used to blind themselves so that they would not be distracted from philosophy, or that Plato died of shame when he was unable to answer a riddle. Students of ancient biography well know that sometimes the slanders and jibes of comic poets seep as factoids into biographical tradition. It is as though Monty Python's Philosopher's Song were taken to be biographical fact. Plato, they say, could stick it away, half a crate of whiskey, every day. One constantly has to be on the lookout for this kind of nonsense. What is more interesting is what the anecdotes tell us in general about Plato. He was huge in his day, a major celebrity, idolised enough for legends to have arisen about him, and for his detractors to go to extreme lengths to try to topple him from his pedestal. And his fame, equal to that of Homer, continued after his lifetime for many centuries. The Platonic Letters.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?